The Katra Foundation presents the Katra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Okay, let's dive in. Today we're looking at someone whose life story might actually be more famous than his name, at least initially, Frank McCourt. He's the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning memoir, Angela's Ashes.
That's right. And it's a book that really shook things up when it came out in 1996.
It really did. It wasn't just a bestseller, it felt like. Well, like a profound statement about resilience, didn't it?
Absolutely. It showed how these incredibly deep wounds from childhood, we're talking crushing, poverty, hunger, abandonment, could eventually be transformed.
And so late in life, he turned it into this powerful, almost transcendent piece of literature, and bam, global fame at 66.
Yeah, and what's really fascinating, I think, is how it sort of redefined the modern memoir.
Oh, so?
Well, before Angela's Ashes, literary autobiographies, they often focused on, you know, celebrities or maybe high political figures. McCourt, he was a retired high school teacher from New York.
Just an ordinary guy, essentially.
Exactly. And he proved that an ordinary life, if you recall it, with extraordinary honesty and wit and real artistry, well, that holds universal power. He kind of normalized the idea that trauma, especially trauma rooted in class and poverty, was a subject worthy of serious literature.
That's a crucial point, not just like a celebrity tell-all. He gave a voice to a struggle that's often just ignored.
Precisely.
So let's trace that journey. It starts in Depression-era Brooklyn, right? 1930.
That's it. He was born to Malachi Sr., who sounds like he was quite the character, charismatic, entertaining.
But also reliably alcoholic, which is key.
Very key. And his mother, Angela, whose strength, I mean, it was just forged in the absolute fire of impossible situations.
And those early years in America, they weren't easy. Constant instability.
No, not at all. And you have that early tragedy, the death of Frank's baby sister, Margaret. The sources really show how that loss just deepened Malachi Sr.'s drinking.
Making it even harder to keep a job, I imagine.
Completely destabilizing for the whole family, which led to that defining move.
Back to Ireland. In 1934, they were kind of defeated by America, weren't they? Gambling on a fresh start in Limerick.
Yeah, hoping for something better in the old country. But instead,
yeah.
Well, it became this tragic slide into even deeper despair.
Because Limerick in the 30s was not the romantic Ireland, some might imagine. Well,
not at all. It was harsh. They ended up living among the absolute poorest in a condemned area called Roden Lane. The poverty wasn't just about money. It was like this pervasive, suffocating thing.
You mentioned that detail before about their house, the nicknames. Can you share that again? It paints such a picture.
It really does. It's this perfect but tragic metaphor. The ground floor flooded constantly with rain, sewage, you name it. So they called it Ireland.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Symbolizing their sinking condition.
Exactly. And the upstairs, which was maybe slightly drier but still miserable, they called Italy.
Signifying what? Like a tiny, almost imaginary hope of climbing out?
Precisely. It just tells you their whole life was this constant, exhausting struggle just to stay, well, literally above water.
Heartbreaking. So, okay, the formative influences on young Frank weren't just the damp walls. What else was shaping him there in Limerick?
You could say it was sort of a trinity of things.
Mm.
First, obviously, constant gnawing hunger. Just never enough food.
Yeah.
Second, there was this really rigid, punitive Catholic upbringing. It just layered shame and guilt onto lives that were already incredibly difficult.
And the third?
Literature. Books. That became crucial.
Right, because he started school at Lee Mees National School. And that was a mixed bag, wasn't it? You had the Christian brothers.
Oh, yeah. Known for harsh discipline, physical punishment, often shaming the boys for being poor.
But amidst that, somehow literature still managed to shine through occasionally.
Fleeting moments, yes. But then comes this really major turning point. The thing that forced him into adulthood way too soon.
His father leaving for good.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Malachi Sr. went off to England during World War II, supposedly to find work.
But he never sent money back. Just abandoned them.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And Frank, at 11 years old, suddenly had to become the man of the house.
It's so easy to just condemn the father outright. But the book doesn't quite do that, does it? McCourt acknowledges his charm, the stories.
That's the genius of it, I think. He avoids that simple condemnation. Mm-hmm. He presents his father with this devastating honesty. You get the wonderful stories. You feel Frank's deep need for his father.
And then the crushing realization that hoping for him to change or return was just pointless, an illusion.
Right. And it shows such maturity, looking back, to hold both those truths, the love and the disappointment at the same time.
And that abandonment, It really pushed Frank towards self-education, didn't it? Hitting the public library.
Absolutely. Shakespeare, Dickens.
Mm-hmm.
The library became his escape, his real education in a way, mm-hmm. preparing him for the life he dreamed of escaping to.
Mm-hmm.
And later, working as a telegram boy that exposed him to the whole spectrum of Limerick society, the rich, the poor, everyone. It just hardened his resolve. He had to get out.
Which leads to his first huge achievement, really, getting out.
That hard-won freedom. 19 years old, 1949. He'd scraped together every penny, sometimes through desperate means.
Even stealing, the book mentions.
Yes, anything to afford that passage back to New York.
And once he was back in the U.S., things started to shift.
Well, eventually. He served in the U.S. Army, which qualified him for the GI Bill.
Yeah.
And that was the key. It let him do what was impossible in Limerick. Study English at NYU.
A university education. Incredible, given where he started.
Absolutely transformative.
And then for the next 30 years, he wasn't Frank McCourt, the famous author. He was Mr. McCourt, the high school teacher.
And by all accounts, an exceptional one. Places like Stuyvesant High School. He spent decades honing his storytelling skills. Probably without even realizing that's what he was doing, just engaging students.
Do you think he needed that time, that distance, those decades to process it all and write Angela's Ashes without just, you know, bitterness?
That's a really interesting thought. I think possibly, yes. The success came late, but maybe it couldn't have come earlier.
Mm.
Those years teaching, they refined his voice. That conversational style, the humor mixed with the darkness.
He practiced it daily.
Right. He only started writing the book seriously in his 50s. Published it at 66. So that triumph, it really was the culmination of a whole lifetime of observing, experiencing, and then learning how to tell the story.
Okay, so let's dig into the philosophy that got him through all that. What was at the core of his worldview?
Well, it seems deeply shaped by that tension between the Catholic doctrine he grew up with, you know, salvation yeah. through suffering, and the brutal reality of his life, the hunger, the poverty.
So no blind faith then?
No. Not at all. It created this complex relationship with faith. It was kind of reverent in some ways, but also deeply skeptical, questioning.
And what about coping mechanisms?
Storytelling itself, definitely.
Yeah.
And humor, specifically that dark gallows humor. Finding the absurdity in the absolute tragic. That was his primary defense, it seems.
Like finding the Italy upstairs.
Exactly. It wasn't optimism in a naive sense. Oh. It was pragmatic hope. He understood the grim reality.
So hope without illusion. He wasn't pretending positive thinking would fix leaky ceilings or find his dad a job.
Precisely. But he refused to let those circumstances crush his spirit, his ability to imagine something better, and, crucially, to work relentlessly towards it. That pragmatic determination defined his survival.
Okay, let's pinpoint three specific moments, the real turning points that shifted his path towards that eventual success.
Right. The first one has to be the fever hospital. When he was 10, he got typhoid fever, a really dangerous situation, quarantine.
A place of death, potentially.
Yeah, but ironically, it became this intellectual awakening for him.
Because that's where he encountered Shakespeare, through another patient.
Exactly. A girl named Patricia Madigan, who was also dying. She read poetry and Shakespeare to him, and after she passed away...
Someone else stepped in.
A hospital porter named Seamus. He kept sneaking Frank books. That experience, it planted the seed. It showed him that art, stories... They could offer a kind of salvation, even right there in the shadow of death.
Wow. Like finding a different kind of parent, almost, in those books.
In a way, yes. Especially compared to the rigid school system and his absent father. Books offered truth, autonomy, hope.
Okay, pivotal moment number two. We've touched on it, but his father's final betrayal.
Yes. When Malachy Sr. went to England during the war and the money just stopped coming, that was it. The final nail in the coffin for any childhood illusions Frank might have clung to.
And that wasn't just abandonment. It was a strange kind of liberation.
In a harsh way, yes. It forced him at 13 to fully accept that no one else was coming to rescue him or his family. He had to be the provider. It absolutely cemented his resolve to escape. He stopped waiting and started planning his own salvation.
Okay, and the third point, this one's maybe the most morally murky.
Definitely the most ethically complex. It's the compromise he made to get the money for America, working for Mrs. Finnegan.
The moneylender.
Right. A cruel woman. And Frank's job was to use his literacy, his greatest gift, really to write threatening letters to her poor, debt-ridden neighbor.
Using his skill to profit from the misery of people just like his own family.
Exactly. He writes about the profound shame and guilt it caused him. But the desperation, the absolute need to get that ticket to America, it overrode everything else.
And then the final act. taking her money after she died.
Yes. Which he frames as, well, part theft, part maybe karmic justice. It's ambiguous. But it was that final desperate act that secured his passage. It highlights that intense drive for self-preservation, even at a significant moral cost. That was his break for freedom.
And the memoir itself, it doesn't shy away from any of this complexity, does it? Especially in how he portrays his family.
No, that's maybe its greatest strength and nuance. Think about his mother, Angela.
Yeah, it's such a tough portrayal. She endures unimaginable humiliation to keep her kids alive. Begging, borrowing.
Yet Frank's memory isn't simple pity or heroism. It's this tangled mix of deep love, yes, but also frustration at her perceived passivity sometimes, her inability to break the cycle herself.
And his father, too, not just a villain.
Not at all. Presented with love, anger, and eventually a kind of pained understanding. McCourt's life, as he tells it, really shows that survival isn't just about strength. It's intelligence, it's moral courage, sometimes moral compromise. He almost insists that just enduring circumstances like that is heroic in itself.
Okay, so if we boil this all down, based on this deep dive, what are the key takeaways for you, the listener? Let's try for three main ones.
All right, well, first, maybe an emotional insight.
Yeah, what's the emotional core here?
I think it's the profound truth that love and loyalty can absolutely coexist with anger, disappointment, even resentment within families. McCourt's really complex feelings towards his parents.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of give us permission to acknowledge the messiness in our own family relationships, you know? It's okay for it to be complicated.
That's powerful. Okay, what about an intellectual insight? Something about knowledge or ideas?
For me, it's how education and literacy function. They're not just practical tools to get ahead, although they are that too. They're also spiritual resources for survival.
Like the books in the fever hospital.
Exactly. Developing your mind, engaging intellectually, even finding that dark humor, it can give you meaning and direction, even when society denies you formal opportunities. Escaping your circumstances often starts with escaping inside your own head.
Good one. Okay, and finally, a universal insight, something practical we can all maybe apply.
I'd say it's about resilience. Real resilience isn't about avoiding hardship. It's about developing the capacity to find meaning and humor and connection within the tough times.
So it's not the adversity itself, but your response to it.
Your measured, pragmatic response.
Yeah.
That matters more. Finding ways to keep going, keep hoping, keep striving, even when things seem impossible.
It's definitely a story that challenges myths, too. That romanticized view of Ireland, for instance.
Oh, completely. It brought brutal attention to systemic poverty and how it just crushes potential. McCourt's story shows individual effort is vital, sure, but it also screams that social conditions can severely, unfairly limit your chances.
So the final thought then. McCourt's journey from that miserable Irish Catholic childhood in Roden Lane to a Pulitzer Prize winner decades later, it really proves it's never too late, does it?
Never too late to chase those deep aspirations.
And maybe the challenge for us, for you listening, is this. If your own life story feels complicated, maybe messy, are you willing to do that difficult but ultimately liberating work? To tell your own truth with honesty, with humanity, and maybe even find a little hope in it? That's something to think about.
Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.